session number 28660, Captain Robert Bonner, Reel 9. Now, how did you settle in to the village of Crowe with the sea company? I mean, where did you live? I mean, what was your accommodation going to be?
The camp at Crowe was located about half a mile away from the village of Crowe. It was a wartime, it was a temporary construction at the time, consisting of one hard metal road through the centre of the camp, with on one side three or four Nissen huts, which were the company headquarters and company stores. There were a couple of large wooden buildings, which were the men's dining hall and the sergeant's mess. And then on the other side of this strip road, up a slight hill, were the tents of the officers' mess and the officers' quarters. A relatively small area, and everybody, officers and soldiers alike, slept under canvas. It was surrounded by a wire fence with barbed wire and constantly patrolled, of course, by the soldiers. Only one entrance, with a small guard room, which again was a small Nissen hut, and a barrier across the road. It is, incidentally, all these years later, still in use as a jungle training centre for the Federation of Malayan Police. And although all our temporary buildings have gone, the layout is basically the same.
So it was a defended perimeter then?
A defended perimeter.
So you were in tent accommodation. What was it like living in tents in the jungle? In this environment? Was it single one-man tent for the officers?
No. We all lived in sort of small marquee-type tents. So accommodation was for everybody in sort of relatively small marquee-type tents. I suppose a section of soldiers living together in each one, so there were probably 12 soldiers to a tent. I remember very clearly that we had problems with mosquitoes at the time, and one of the items we used to come to get rid of these was metal bombs full of DDT, which we sprayed mercilessly and extensively over everything in and around the tents. And of course, nowadays we wouldn't have been allowed anywhere near them. But nobody suffered any repercussions from using these bombs of DDT, and it certainly did the trick of killing the mosquitoes.
Did you have anti-mosquito nets?
Yes, every bed had a green mosquito net. And these were obviously constantly in use. There was no question, I don't think, of anybody not using their mosquito net.
What about anti-malaria tablet? Was it methacrine or quinine? I'm not quite sure. No. Changes
there. We had the routine. Everybody had to take anti-malaria tablets, which I think were methacrine, every day. Which was it became a discipline, and nobody and thank goodness for it.
And no one got malaria.
Nobody got malaria. No.
What about food? Your rations while you were there. We'll do the operational side. Might as well do the living conditions. What sort of food were you getting?
This is where the. The contractor. Now we'll just look and see if I got his name somewhere around here. Let me just have a look.
Can't find the name. You were going to say that about the food and the contractor.
Yep. It was, of course, whilst we were in our jungle locations, the the regimental contractor came into his own, and he provided his charwallas, of course, had come up with us from Singapore. They were very much now a part of the battalion, and he provided the cook for the officers and the sergeants' messes. The soldiers were catered for by the cooks from the Army Catering Corps, and the Russians would come up once a week up this long road from Baling and Klianintan. I'll give you that name, Klian, new word, Intan, Intan. So the Russians would come up as a combination of the contractors' food and also food and drinks supplied by by NAFI.
What was the food like supplied by this contractor for you, the officers and the sergeants? I mean, was it just the normal stuff, or was it different?
No.
Indian, or what was it nature?
To the best of my recollection at the time, curry had not become such an important part of the British cuisine as it is now. And I think the meals that everybody had on camp, and this probably applied everywhere, were exactly the same as we would have had in our barracks in Chester or Berlin. Entirely a British cuisine.
What about water rations? Water supply?
There was a water supply. Water presented no problem. There was a water supply on the camp.
Clean and filtrated, you know?
Well, I suppose being on top of a mountain, it couldn't have been any purer, frankly. And then quite a lot of sort of local grown fruit was bought, and it was also possible for people to go into the village of Crow, and if necessary, sort of buy local fruit from the two or three merchants that were working there.
What about the latrines? What are rented with it? Were they sort of normal latrines, or thunderboxes, or the old trench?
Good question. I can't really remember much about the latrine system, except they were inspected every day, of course, by the duty officer. And we had one particular corporal whose main responsibility in life was looking after the cleanliness and the condition of the latrines, whatever type they were, throughout the camp. And I know from memory that he took his duties extremely seriously, and was a sort of, as a result, he got a lot of ribbing from his fellow soldiers. But he did a great job, and nobody ever had any cause to complain about the cleanliness of the latrines.
So how did you settle into life? And what your duties were going?
Well, our first, we were taking over from a battalion of Gurkha soldiers, and we didn't have very much time to take over our duties from them, but they showed us the layout of the whole operational area, and I'm sure we learned quite a lot of tricks from them at the time. They were delightful people to soldier with, and we had several pleasant days in their company. But then we, in conjunction with the local police, spent the first few days really just getting to know the feel of the area.
Now, how do you do that? How do you get the feel of an area? Do you go on patrol, or would you just walk around?
There really was a routine about this, which every morning what were called prayers were held at the local police headquarters with the OCPD, the district officer, and the officer commanding the Krogh garrison, as it were, together with the head of the police special branch in the area. And the object of this meeting was to go over the events of the previous 24 hours and to discuss all possibilities of tracing and tracking down terrorists. So this was the first normal duty of the day, and then as a result of that, the commanding officer, the company commander, in this case a man called Roberts, Major Roberts, would come back to the camp, and unless something had already been pre-arranged, would brief platoon commanders on the what their role was going to be, either for that day or for the next few days. And prayers, sort of morning prayers, which were carried out throughout the whole of Malaya on a similar basis, was an important part of everybody's routine.
What might you be briefed to do as a particular? Would you kept, you were certainly inclined to the company. I'm not quite sure where you fit in. Would you be at the prayers?
A second in command of the company, my role at that time was purely administrative, to ensure the smooth running of the company and the camp, whilst the Robbie, the company commander, could get on with the actual controlling and organising of the operational aspect of our being there. We had the other officers in Krogh at that time were three national service officers, Crispin Worthington, Martin Blackburn, and John Penny. Three very delightful, intelligent, and capable young men, all of whom went on to achieve great things in their later life as civilians.
They were in no way inferior from what you're saying to regular officers.
Not at all. No, they were. Although they had all been, they had been sort of bundled into the army. Only Crispin Worthington had any military background, basically because his father and his uncles had served in battalions of the regiment during the First World War and had all distinguished themselves. And so, of course, he was well imbued with regimental and military background. But Martin Blackburn and John Penny were had no previous military experience, but they all proved to be efficient and, I should say, popular platoon commanders. And they would always would be one platoon on standby and probably two platoons out on operations, which could be either independent or working with the police. Certainly in the first few weeks, the police in one form or another would work closely with the platoon commanders in their patrolling, because they had a good knowledge of the lie of the land and the natives and the people within it.
Did you ever go out on these platoon patrols? I can understand it's not your role, but sometimes people.
Yes, I went out on, as you can imagine, life inside the camp, just purely doing administration, was not the most exciting. So there would be times when we would have a rather larger operational requirement, and I would go out with one or two patrols and just carry out the duties of a normal patrol leader.
Can we go through what a typical patrol was like, preferably one that you were on, but how, so they get briefed in the morning, or well, they'd be briefed, But could you just take us through, you know, exactly the whole thing, or how many men were on it, what people were armed with, and then take us through from there. So how would the patrol be organised?
Most patrols were, I'm sorry, all patrols were led either by an officer or a senior non-commissioned officer. And I suppose as time went on, more and more patrols were led by senior NCOs as their experience grew. There was no set routine, of course, because the terrorists had eyes and ears everywhere and were constantly watching movement from all the British Army camps throughout the country, so that any preparation would have been seen and reported back to the local terrorists. So routine was a word which was not in use. Patrols might perhaps go out in the middle of the night in the dark and to a prearranged position where they would wait until the dawn and then carry out an ambush or something like that. There was one particular incident I remember whilst we were in Crewe, that we knew a certain a terrorist had made approaches to a rubber tapper and frightened him into returning the following day and leaving some money in a tin by a tree which was were being tapped, and he was going to come back for that the following day. So after having been briefed as an emergency by the local special branch policeman, I took a small patrol of hand-picked soldiers at the time. We borrowed bicycles. We walked down to the police station in the dark of the evening, and there a supply of bicycles had been prepared for us, and we got on our bicycles and quietly sped through the village and along the road to a prearranged position where the police were waiting for us to relieve us of the bicycles, and we then went into the jungle, and I suppose it would be about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, pitch black, and found ourselves in the area where we hoped the bandit was going to appear the following day, and laid an ambush for him. So that was sort of one of those things which you hadn't anticipated and hadn't planned, but had to be put into operation fairly rapidly. But on the whole,
did he pick up the? I mean, did you catch him?
Well, it's all rather embarrassing, really. We were all beautifully in position and hidden away. We hoped, the dawn came, and suddenly, by this tree appeared a man who, just wearing khaki shorts, who looked just like any ordinary Malay rubber tapper, but obviously wasn't. I had given instructions that everyone had to wait till I fired the first round. Unfortunately, a trigger-happy person beside me decided that this was too much, and he fired using an American carbine, which he was armed with, which misfired. There was a loud click, which echoed throughout the jungle in the early hours of that morning, and without any hesitation, our little communist terrorist had disappeared. We then broke the cover of the ambush, firing automatic fire all over the place to try and get the man. A tracker dog was brought up within minutes from our previous rendezvous, and we set off after this man, but unfortunately, it was an absolute disaster, and on that occasion, we did not get our man.
When you went out on the patrol, you'd go out, you'd avoid routine at what time you started and the rest of it. I presume you'd avoid routine in the route as well.
That's right.
What formation would you adopt going to the, I mean, how many would there be on? The whole platoon, for what, 30 or
no, what? No. Patrols were normally of about well, it could be a whole platoon, but on the whole, probably 12 or 14 people.
And what armament and what weapons would they be carrying?
Usually the composition would be one fairly strong man, or indeed a good strong man, carrying a Bren gun, which he would carry suspended with by straps over his neck and shoulder, a very heavy weapon, and it needed a man of considerable energy and strength to carry this day in, day out, plodding slowly through the hot atmosphere of the jungle. The majority of others would be armed with the jungle, American carbines, which we were using, and I can't remember the...
Why were you using them and not the old Lee Enfield?
Well, the Lee Enfield was a rather large, cumbersome weapon in the to carry in the hot atmosphere of the jungle all day long, and these American carbines were much lighter and on the whole apart from, very efficient, so we apart from that one occasion
so that was a one-off. It wouldn't
that was a one-off really.
What are the weapons?
And that was really it.
Would you take your grenades with you and bayonets?
We all had grenades and we all carried bayonets.
What about Sten guns?
Sten guns were not very popular.
Can you explain it? I've heard that before, but why weren't the Sten guns? I would have thought short range
The Stens, although they're sort of designed for their short range and intensive fire, were not all that accurate because of their construction and the atmosphere of the hot, damp jungle. They were liable to misfire or the springs to seize up. They were not very popular, but the Owen gun, which I believe was an Australian invention, was of similar size to the Sten and became a very popular automatic weapon to be carried by patrols.
So what formation would you adopt?
Well, there was only one formation to adopt because the... everywhere the route would be a single jungle track.
And would you have a point, what these, well, I think the Americans call a point, you know, someone going 10 yards ahead to trip anything that was going to happen?
Always there was a leading scout who was specially selected, and although this was possibly the most dangerous position to be in the patrol, it required a man of good determination, good eyesight, and sense of smell, and caution to be in that position. So the leading scout was of vital importance, and he would be 10 yards or so in front of probably the patrol commander, who would follow behind.
So you'd be second.
Yes. And then everybody else would follow at a gap of 10 to 12 yards.
So it's quite spread out. It's
a long, long distance.
Where would the NCO be? At the back? Who would be? Was the back position considered important?
The back position, very important, because he had to have eyes not only to the front and the sides, but also to the rear. And it was not unknown for terrorists to spring an ambush once the rear man had gone through. So the second senior person in the patrol, probably a sergeant or a corporal, would be bringing up the rear.
What was the terrain in the jungle like? Because I can't picture it at all. It's difficult for people to imagine. What sort of jungle was it? Jungle, or light jungle, or not really jungly at all, because it sort of ranges. I mean, people call it jungle, but there's lots of different times.
I think I've got an aid memoir here, I think. Can I just stop recording for a moment?
Okay.
I think it's fair to say that the jungle in Malaya was even worse than that had been experienced by our predecessors in the Second Manchesters in Burma during World War II. In overgrown secondary jungle, which is jungle which had been previously cleared by the natives and had really become even denser than ordinary primary jungle, it was movement was so slow it was really could barely cover a mile in 4 hours. It would necessitate our parangs, which everybody carried, being used probably to slash a way through the front. It was so impenetrable. ordinary jungle would be consist of the jungle trees and the overgrown, what I suppose, sort of shrubs, lots of bamboo, lots of long grass called lalang, and sometimes with the overhanging trees, the sun will be completely shut out, and it was important to be able to cut your way through. So, of course, that ruined the question of quietness and surprise. So one had to be very careful where this was carried out and which sort of jungle you were going through at the time. I suppose one of the most unpleasant things about the jungle itself was that the leeches. Well, leeches were everywhere, and they've dropped onto everybody, working their way through to the flesh, where they would clamp themselves on and commence to suck themselves and suck your blood. It's not like suck your blood. And in addition to that, of course, there was constant damp heat saturating our jungle green clothing. And it wasn't long before everybody was absolutely soaked through. The leeches, of course, you had to be careful with, because if you try to pluck them off, their heads would remain in your body and possibly go septic afterwards. A quick way of getting rid of them, of course, was when we stopped for a rest to get out a cigarette and burn them off. But a quick flick of the finger would probably do the trick as well. But they were very unpleasant, and they got into the most awkward and personal parts of the body, causing a lot of irritation.
Any other, what they call the creepy crawly end of life? I mean, snakes, any problem with snakes?
The jungle is alive with all sorts of creepy crawlers, and although the majority of them were sensed that we were around and really were disinterested in getting any closer, so that although we came across snakes quite frequently, they were not very happy to see us and probably slithered away out of the way very, very quickly. But our I hadn't mentioned, on our patrols we usually had one of our either had a guide of the Malayan police native, or one of our Ibans, who were the trackers that the army had employed, who came from Borneo. These were the descendants of the famous headhunters of Borneo, and they were very knowledgeable about jungle lore, and they would if they saw a snake or an animal or creature that they thought might make a decent meal, then of course they grabbed it, and before any of us even saw the wretched thing. And of course at night,